Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Ira Melman reporting from both U.S. and Iranian officials an assessment of Iran nuclear talks. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says the stakes are high on reaching an agreement with Iran on its nuclear program and that negotiators don't just want any deal. He told reporters in Lausanne, Switzerland Saturday that important gaps remain in reaching an agreement and that fundamental decisions must be made now. Kerry made the comments just before heading to London for discussions with a P5 plus one group that has been negotiating with Iran.
In London, we will share ideas this evening about how to resolve the remaining sticking points, as I did yesterday on the telephone with Foreign Minister Lavrov and Foreign Minister Wang Yi. We will coordinate our strategy as we approach the end of the March deadline to reach an understanding on the major issues.
Kerry said talks with Iran will resume next week in Switzerland. Earlier in the day, Iranian President Hassan Rouhani said it is possible to have an agreement with world powers about its nuclear capabilities. While acknowledging differences still remain, Mr. Rouhani said there is nothing that cannot be resolved. A U.S. federal judge ruled Friday the government must release photographs showing how detainees were treated at the Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq and other sites. Judge Alvin Hellerstein's ruling takes effect in 2 months, giving the government time to decide if it will appeal. The ACLU, American Civil Liberties Union, filed a lawsuit seeking the release of those pictures. This is VOA News. In his first speech since fleeing the capital, Yemen's embattled president has struck a defiant stance, challenging the Shiite rebels who once held him captive. President Abd Rabbu Mansour Hadi said Saturday that the Houthi rebels' rule in Sana'a and elsewhere in Yemen is a coup against constitutional legitimacy. Speaking from Aden, Hadi declared the city a temporary capital for the Arab world's poorest country. He also addressed the leader of the rebels, Abdul Malik al-Houthi, telling him to stop trying to trick the Yemeni people. Hadi accused Iran of backing the rebels, a claim the rebels deny. Hadi escaped house arrest in Sana'a last month. The Houthis have taken over Sana'a and 9 of that country's 21 provinces over the past 6 months, raising fears of a civil war. Hundreds of Tunisians marched through the capital of Tunis Friday, not only marking the 59th anniversary of the country's independence from France, but also rallying against terrorism 2 days after a deadly attack on Tunisia's National Museum. Most of the more than 20 people killed in the massacre, claimed by the Islamic State group, were foreign tourists. Poland's foreign ministry announced Friday that a third Polish citizen had died. Another 10 Poles were wounded in Wednesday's mass shooting. In a statement honoring Tunisia's National Day, Secretary of State John Kerry said the United States condemns in the strongest terms the heinous and cowardly act perpetrated by the terrorist at the historic National Bardo Museum, but he said it cannot diminish the shining example of Tunisia and its dedication to democracy. Soldiers from Niger and Chad who liberated the Nigerian town of Damasak from Boko Haram militants have discovered the bodies of at least 70 people, many with their throats slit, scattered under a bridge. Reuters reports that in what appeared to be an execution style for the execution site for the Islamist group, the bodies were strewn beneath the concrete bridge on one of the main roads leading out of the town. The condition of the bodies, partially mummified by the dry desert air, with grass beginning to grow around the corpses, suggested that the killings had taken place some time ago. U.S. First Lady Michelle Obama is calling on Cambodian students to stay in school and take advantage of their education to demand greater freedoms in their Southeast Asia country. Cambodia has been ruled for 30 years by strongman Hun Sen, the prime minister, whose wife joined Mrs. Obama on her visit Saturday to the northern city of Siem Reap. Mrs. Obama is on a 5-day trip to Asia to promote the U.S.-led education initiative, Let Girls Learn, which she and the president announced earlier in the month. The community-based program is to be run by the Peace Corps. I'm Ira Melman.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. Peter Clot is away. I'm Douglas Impoga sitting in for him.
National pride, 25 years of fairly steady progress, and that's most notably peace and stability since independence in 1990.
Namibians mark 25 years of independence as a new president is inaugurated.
For virtually all Nigerians, there's a lot of hope that these elections would be free, fair, credible, and above all, violence-free.
A government expert looks ahead to next week's elections in Nigeria.
Nous on est toujours disponible à travailler avec les FARDC et comme vous disiez, on a.
Ruiz says we are always available to work with the Congolese army and we have often worked with units or officers who were suspected of human rights violations.
And United Nations officials confirm that their mission in the Democratic Republic of Congo in the past worked with Congolese army officers who were suspected of having committed human rights violations. Those stories and more coming up right here on Nightline Africa. In Namibia, Hage Geingob has been inaugurated as president of the Southern African nation. Today also marks the 25th anniversary of independence of the Republic of Namibia. Graham Hopwood is the executive director of the Institute for Policy Research and a former journalist for the Namibian newspaper. I reached him in the capital a short while ago and asked him how the country was marking the day.
I think that's the real mood of national pride. 25 years of fairly steady progress, and perhaps most notably peace and stability since independence in 1990. So there was a real sense of national pride. Also at the changeover of power, the handover to the new president, Hage Geingob, which has gone very smoothly. Although it's the same party in power, it's still an achievement, I think, when African nations do change their presidents and term limits are kept to.
Yeah, you mentioned change of power there, and Namibia has been politically stable, and change of government so far has been peaceful and democratic. What, in your opinion, do you think did the Namibians get right that some of the other countries in Africa that have been independent for over 50 years don't get?
I think the policy of national reconciliation has helped to ensure peace in the country since 1990. And then I think the government, by and large, has tried to spend its money on the right priorities. So it's always had education as its largest ministry in terms of the budget amount it receives. So I think there's been, although Namibia hasn't made huge steps in terms of tackling poverty and inequality since 1990, there has been some steady progress. And I think enabled people to make some advances in their lives and communities to also make some progress. And therefore, it's established a very strong sense of stability in the country. There's really very little and no sort of intra-tribal or inter-community violence in the country at all.
The Liberation Party, SWAPO, has been in power all these 25 years. Is there a fear that the dominance of one party maybe negates some of the development in democratic institutions?
Well, that's true. And I mean, the share of the votes for the ruling party has actually gone up over time. So at the last election in November last year, they got 80%, which is almost unheard of in a country that's generally regarded as democratic. But I think what SWAPO has shown is that you can actually retain popularity and win elections without resorting to authoritarian or dictatorial methods. So really we've had very sort of open society. The media in Namibia is regarded as the freest or among the freest in Africa. So somehow they've managed to retain popularity without perhaps using the sort of stereotypical methods of African regimes of some kind of authoritarianism to retain that control. There's an open atmosphere in the country, and the constitution, which is committed to freedom of expression and human rights, has by and large been respected.
What do you see going forward as a big challenge for the country?
The two big challenges, I think, are poverty and unemployment. Namibia has a very young population. About half the population is actually under 21. So youth unemployment and poverty amongst younger people is a major issue, which hasn't yet been effectively tackled. So that was the tone of the Inca president's speech today, that he really wants to tackle those issues to see progress in the next 5 years.
Thank you. That was Graham Hopwood, the Executive Director, Institute for Policy Research, and a former journalist for the Namibian newspaper. I talked to him earlier today from the capital of Windhoek. Now I'm joined by my colleague here, Shaka Sali, host of VOA's premier show, Straight Talk Africa. Ndugu Shaka, welcome to the show.
Well, Douglas, I have to say I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to be on your show, Nightline Africa.
Thank you very much, Shaka. Now, Ndugu, you know today, Silver Jubilee in Namibia, with a brand new president. This is Hage Geingob. He won elections by landslide, 87%. Tell us briefly, who is this man?
An incredible man, Douglas. I had the opportunity, for example, to spend a week with Dr. Hage Geingob, by the way, because, in fact, he does have a PhD from the University of Leeds in the United Kingdom. And he had a very interesting dissertation topic. It was state formation in Namibia, promoting democracy and good governance. Mm-hmm. That tells you a lot about Hage Geingob. He's a Pan-Africanist.
Indeed. He's 73 years old. He's been in the system long because he was former prime minister.
Oh, yes. As a matter of fact, he was in Namibia as the first prime minister back in 1990 up to 2002. And then I met him here in Washington, D.C. in 2003. That's when I first met him. And he happened to be at that time Executive Secretary General of Global Coalition for Africa, which is associated with the Bretton Woods, especially the World Bank. Mm-hmm. He's an incredible man. I had the opportunity to host him a couple of times on Straight Talk Africa. And as a matter of fact, I remember one time hosting him with then Dr. Susan Rice, who is currently the National Security Advisor to President Barack Obama. And he had very strong views, especially about the land reform situation in Zimbabwe. Mm-hmm. He's an incredibly Pan-Africanist. He's a man who started out his career, frankly, as a primary teacher and later traveled to the United States and attended universities like Temple and then later graduated from Fordham University with a bachelor's degree and then got a master's degree from the New School of Social Research in New York. He is incredibly talented, has an incredibly great sense of humility. He has the kind of experience, frankly, that I think not only Namibia, but perhaps also Africa needs, really.
And the good thing is Namibia is scores highly on the governance and democratic issues scale. And this gentleman is replacing Paul Hamba, who just won the Mo Ibrahim Africa Leadership Prize. Well, so good fit, good replacement.
Oh, that is correct. There is no question that he refers to Hifikepunye Pohamba as Comrade Pohamba, just as much as he refers to the founding president, Comrade Sam Nujoma. I think that a lot is expected of him. There will be challenges, but I hope that frankly, he has the opportunity to be the best president that Namibia can have, and in fact, Africa for that matter.
Thank you very much, Ndugu Shaka Sali, host of VOA's premier program, Straight Talk Africa. Thank you.
You're most welcome, sir.
Nigerians go to polls next week, but how prepared is the country's electoral body, INEC? VOA's Peter Klot is in Nigeria, and he caught up with Dr. Jubrin Ibrahim, a governance expert, and asked him this and other issues related to next week's elections.
I think for virtually all Nigerians, there's a lot of hope that these elections would be free, fair, credible, and above all, violence-free. This is because the stakes are very high. This is the first election in which you have a very strong opposition, which is capable of standing its ground with the incumbent government. What we do hope for is that some of the electoral malpractices that have affected previous elections should not occur this time, so that at the end of the day, it's the Nigerian citizens that will determine who emerges as their president, their governor, and as their legislators.
So let me ask you, so far with the way the Electoral Commission has put in measures to ensure the vote is credible, what is your assessment as a governance expert? What is your assessment of how they have performed so far in terms of organizing and anticipated administering this election next week?
I think they have adopted a lot of measures that will increase the integrity of the elections. The permanent voter's card and the card reader are two innovations that will definitely, if used, create a situation in which the tradition of inflating votes will not recur this time.
Accepting the election result is very critical. How do you think these political parties are going to react? Because the way they react determines whether there could be violence or not. Have they committed themselves to accepting the outcome of the elections and that they have confidence in the organizational ability of the Electoral Commission or INEC to administer a credible election and as a result accept the outcome of the election?
Well, a national peace accord has been signed by the leading political parties and their candidates, in which they commit themselves to ensure that the campaign is violent-free and there is no hate speech, and in which they further commit themselves to accept the election results if they are credible. And that's where the caveat is. I think historically, people accept election results if they believe they are credible and that they actually represent the choices made by citizens.
Finally, let me ask you, people have expressed concern about the tensed atmosphere, and some are saying, well, we're going to other West African countries because we are not sure if there could be spontaneous violence and all that. As an expert, what would you tell such people who are peddling some of these issues around?
Well, I think we've had a long history of difficult elections in this country. And sometimes there has been violence, but the violence has never been all-consuming. And Nigerians do have a capacity in periods of national difficulty to find a way out of the crisis. It's therefore important that we do not panic, that we do not expect the worst. And I think really having confidence in the process, which we know is an improved process from previous elections, is imperative in allowing us to move forward.
That was Dr. Jabrin Ibrahim, a Nigerian governance expert. He spoke with my colleague, Peter Klote, from Abuja. United Nations officials have confirmed that the UN mission in the Democratic Republic of Congo, known as MONUSCO, has in the past worked with Congolese army officers who were suspected of having committed human rights violations. Mission Chief Martin Kobler told media it happened too often. For VOA, Nick Long reports from Goma in eastern Congo.
MONUSCO Chief Martin Kobler made the comments Thursday at the United Nations in New York, saying the mission had previously waived UN rules too generously so as to be able to work alongside Congolese army officers suspected of violations. Speaking after a UN Security Council meeting, Kobler said that among those Congolese officers were two generals that the mission decided in February it could not support because of the UN's human rights policy. Because of that decision, MONUSCO has not taken part in a major offensive led by those generals against Rwandan FDLR rebels. On Friday in Goma, the head of the MONUSCO Bureau, Daniel Ruiz, spoke to VOA about his boss's statement in New York. Ruiz says, we are always available to work with the Congolese army, and we have often worked with units or officers who were suspected of human rights violations. One must remember that the DRC had a terrible civil war recently, and things like that happen in civil wars. Martin Kobler also told journalists in New York that the mission had supported the two generals in the past because it thought the DRC government was taking punitive action against them and had given their cases to the military prosecutor. However, this had not happened in several cases. 118 Congolese army officers are on MONUSCO's list of suspected human rights abusers, Kobler said, and the mission should not cooperate with them. But in Goma, MONUSCO's Ruiz says the mission has not ruled out collaborating with officers suspected of human rights violations.
Les Nations Unies a une politique générale dans toutes les missions de paix pour précisément.
He says the UN has a general policy in all peacekeeping operations to prevent violations and taking measures to avoid them. That doesn't necessarily mean, he says, that we cannot support units that have officers who are suspected of human rights violations. There are measures that can be taken, he adds. For example, human rights officers can be placed close to those units or military observers where there are joint operations. He stressed that there is no blanket ban on collaborating with suspected abusers.
Donc, il ne faut pas croire que parce qu'il y a un officier qui est soupçonné.
Ruiz also says we mustn't think that because there's an officer suspected of human rights violations that we can't work with his unit. He says it depends on the circumstances, on the case, and on the measures taken by the government and by the UN. Congo watchers say there has been disagreement within MONUSCO on this issue. Bureau Chief Ruiz confirms there are sometimes disagreements among MONUSCO's staff.
Moi-même, je suis pas toujours d'accord avec Monsieur Kobler. Après, dans ce cas, lui, c'est mon chef et moi, j'obéis. Même
I sometimes disagree with Mr. Kobler, he says, but he's my boss, so I do what he tells me, even when I don't agree. In a similar way, he said, there have sometimes been disagreements between the DRC government and MONUSCO, but he says there has never been a breakdown in their relations. Nick Long for VOA News, Goma.
The United Nations Children's Fund reports the warring parties in South Sudan have recruited more than 12,000 child soldiers. UNICEF says boys in many areas of conflict are being rounded up and sent to the front lines to fight. Lisha Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The UN Children's Fund says the Sudan People's Liberation Army had been doing a good job in demobilizing child soldiers after Sudan's long-running civil war ended in 2005. But now, UNICEF representative in South Sudan, Jonathan Veach, says factional fighting in the young nation of South Sudan has triggered a big increase in recruitment by both government and rebel forces.
Our teams on the ground and our partners are reporting a strong upsurge in recruitment at the moment, and it is ongoing. We've received credible and, in some instances, verifiable information that forces aligned with the government and opposition have abducted or coerced hundreds of children into their ranks in the past month alone.
UNICEF reports the situation is particularly acute in the conflict states of Upper Nile and Unity, where hundreds of children have been taken. The agency says it has received credible reports that an unknown number of the children have been sent to the front line. Veitch says the recruitment of children for fighting is a grave violation of child rights. He says children forced to fight suffer long-term physical and psychological damage. He says it also has a terrible impact on their families and communities. The UNICEF representative tells VOA international law defines the recruitment of children under the age of 15 as a war crime.
So there is evidence of forced coercive recruitment of children under the age of 15, and that would be deemed to be a war crime. But of course it's an international crime anyway to recruit children, and it's a national crime as well. The government has signed
significant pledges and action plans with the SRSG Children in Armed Conflict and re-signed that commitment last year, as did the opposition leader Riek Machar.
Veitch says both sides have made commitments several times over and have broken them as well. He notes South Sudan is very big, and this is problematic because command and control of forces is very weak. So even if there is a commitment at the central level to stop child recruitment, Veitch says local commanders are likely to do the opposite. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
They are South Africa's invisible health heroes, the people who care for patients dying of incurable illnesses. In a country with high rates of cancer, heart disorders, and infectious diseases such as AIDS and tuberculosis, demand for their services is high. They provide palliative care, which includes easing the emotional, physical, and spiritual suffering of people who are terminally ill. In short, the nurses and psychologists allow people to die with dignity. Darren Taylor reports in this first part of a series focusing on palliative caregivers in South Africa.
Evelyn Itumeleng watches decades-old reruns of the American crime television series Hawaii Five-O in her sparsely furnished home in Kagiso. Massive mine dumps loom large over the low-cost housing settlements near the town of Krugersdorp. Skin is stretched taut over 54-year-old Itumeleng's face. She's very thin and blinks slowly. She's paralyzed in a wheelchair. Itumeleng has multi-drug-resistant tuberculosis in her spine.
Everything happens for a reason.
MDR-TB is extremely difficult and expensive to treat. The medication has severe side effects and doesn't work for everyone. Itumeleng's also infected with HIV.
Oh, say, I feel a lot of pain, really. I don't like myself to be like this. But I have to accept this situation because I can't turn the clock back. It's just happening.
She says being confined to a wheelchair is torture because she used to be an active person. Tears stream down Itumeleng's sunken cheeks.
I didn't think that one day I could be like this. I was working. I was doing everything for myself. I was looking after my kids. I was looking after these houses for such long time. I was the one who is the breadwinner in this house.
Doctors have told her she has only months left to live because she started TB and HIV treatment too late. But she seethes. I'll never give up.
I've got that hope one day things will come right. Anything's possible.
Snowy Nkwana's high heels crunch down a path in Mansiville, also near Krugersdorp. The veteran nurse walks past a few women washing clothes. Some are infected with HIV. South Africa has the largest public sector antiretroviral program in the world. The state gives life-prolonging ARV drugs to almost 3 million people. But Nkwana says many patients she sees don't adhere to strict guidelines about how to take the medication.
When they default, then hell breaks loose. They start becoming ill. They even die because of being non-compliant. In this era, we shouldn't be having too many HIV/AIDS deaths. We shouldn't be.
Nkwana says South Africa's failing to end the stigma that surrounds HIV. She says some infected people don't take ARVs because they'd rather die than be exposed as having HIV. For many of South Africa's terminally ill, all they have left is prayer. That, says Itumeleng, and seemingly endless repeats of Hawaii Five-O on national TV. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
This is Nightline Africa, and coming up in the second half of the program, the Saturday Music Spot from our collection of music from across the continent. Then we'll have a commentary by Dr. Suleiman Yang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University. It's now time for a Saturday Music Spot. Let's begin with some music from Namibia. So sit back, relax, and enjoy.
Shanda tokoro kuharo kukongo Shandi piramene gongo eto
Only you 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 Only you
Kile nyano, Yeah. cappuccino. Nyakala kolenga kepusiro. Sitamina, superpower, sikomita, sikamita. Nakulava dissidency, tokotanga turbulence. Hey, girls of papa, so nice. My beautiful baby, so nice.
Oh, mama mia, oh, I wanna so let you know. Oh, I'll never let you down. Oh, I love you so. Oh, mama, yeah, yeah,
oh. Kufuka moto kantambula sida bangenda. Kufuna ntambula tulaba. Mai bebe njagaru kufuna. Inengula kukenda tulaba. Hey, kakusome kumu vitabo. Magasin and the newspaper.
You go buy me a rope. Oh, hey. Carry me go for overseas. Oh, hey. To begin. Sita kuliamo chalo, kuliamo chalo, sita
Wow, that's Ugandan Hindu Asha with the Saza Musango, and brings us to the end of our music spot tonight. And now the Saturday commentary by Dr. Suleiman Yang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University here in Washington. Hello, Dr. Yang.
Hello, Africa. It's always nice to share my reflections with the people of the continent. Today, I want to share my reflections on U.S. policy towards Africa in light of changing things in the world. Africa is a big continent with many nations, with many people who are trying to develop themselves like other peoples around the planet. The United States is a leading nation which is very attractive to Africa and other parts of the world. In this particular context, when you look at American policy towards Africa and you pay attention to African opinions on and attitude towards the United States, you have so many things to address. There is the question of culture, cultural relationship between the United States and Africa. There is the question of politics and the whole question of governance in Africa and in the United States. There is the question of economic development, which is key in terms of America's relations with Africa. Then there is the whole question of the environment and the manner in which the Africans are dealing with their own environments, just like Americans are dealing with their own environment. So when you talk about diplomacy between the United States and Africa, all these areas come to mind. Let us look at the question of diplomacy and politics between the two regions of the world. The United States, as a big power, is still very much involved in the affairs of the rest of the world. When you look at America's relations with Africa, you can see state building and nation building are primary objectives of African countries. Africa has 54 nations in light of developments in Eritrea and in South Sudan. Eritrea came out of Ethiopia to create an other nation in Africa. Then you have South Sudan. The critical issue is the U.S. government has a big role to play in South Sudan. Nation building and state building are very critical for South Sudanese. And the political leaders in South Sudan must learn from the American experience, must learn from what happened elsewhere in Africa because of civil war and crisis. The Nigerians solved their friend crisis and were able to move forward. Right now, the South Sudanese should be watching the Nigerians closely and see to what extent American diplomacy in Nigeria, American diplomacy in their own country are very much related to one another. The Vice President of the United States has made it categorically clear to the Nigerian leadership, as it is now known in the media, that the Americans are particularly interested in Nigerian democracy because with good democracy and good governance, American policy would be advanced immeasurably in Nigeria. But if the Nigerians do not learn from their civil war and the politicians are very much preoccupied with personal ambition and playing the ethnic, regional, or the religious games, then Nigeria is not going to be a good model for sell to them. Ironically, South Sudanese, who benefited from Nigeria intervention during the crisis with Northern Sudan, would be pushed into the same crisis as South Sudan. That is bad news for South Sudanese, bad news for Nigerians, bad news for America, bad news for all the Africans who want to have good governance and stability. This is where the legacies of Ghana, legacies of Senegal, legacy of Tanzania are instructive for the other African countries. How are the Ghanaians, the Senegalese, and the Tanzanians instructive for the other African countries? And what are the implications of these three experiments in America's relations with Africa? Let's begin with the Ghanaians. Kwame Nkrumah was the first African leader who was very much linked to America. He came to America, was educated here, just like Nnamdi Azikiwe, and many other Africans from South Africa, Central Africa, and East Africa. Now, the Ghanaian experience is this. The Ghanaians started with democracy, elected Kwame Nkrumah. And then, unfortunately, for the political evolution of the country, one party state developed, and that became the norm all over Africa. So when you talk about American relationship with Africa, Americans were very much preoccupied with the one-party dictatorship. And that was why you have a big contradiction at that time in American politics. Because of the Cold War, the American government supported Mobutu because Mobutu was from a big country, and Mobutu at that time was perceived to be a stronger person than the other political leaders. Military dictatorship was supported at that time, unfortunately, at the expense of democracy. Today in Ghana, one-party dictatorship is no longer acceptable. Not for the Ghanaians, not for the Africans, not for the Americans. Americans would like to have good governance in Nigeria. That's why the vice president came out. He made it categorically clear that we have to have law and order and good governance in Nigeria. And I think there's a message coming from this country to the Nigerians. Have elections free and fair. If Jonathan wins, let him win. If Buhari wins, let him win. But that is a Nigerian issue, not an American issue, not an African issue, not a world issue. It's a Nigerian issue. The most important point for the Africans is you learn how to be in power, you govern like George Washington did, and then you leave other people to run the country. A political historian who looks at all these countries can see how American policy is evident in all these countries with regard to American policies towards these countries during times of elections and the manner in which American politicians, congressmen or senators who go to these countries reaffirm the need for peaceful transition in government. This happened in Ghana between President Clinton and President Rawlings, and the Ghanaians moved that transition, and they are now where they are today in their political development. It happened in Tanzania, it happened in Senegal. So when the South Sudanese look at their situation and the Nigerians look at their situation, they have to see to what extent political development in Africa is useful to them, and they can cross the Atlantic and learn from the American experience. So when you summarize America's policy towards Africa and you try to understand African opinions on and attitude towards the United States, the question is stability, stability, stability. With stability, you have economic development. And that's the way it is today for Africa and the United States.
Thank you, Dr. Nyang. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, we thank you for joining us tonight. I'll see you tomorrow, Sunday. I'm Douglas Mpuga.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. The U.S. Department of State in early March recognized 10 women from around the globe with the Secretary of State's International Women of Courage Awards. They were honored for their outstanding contributions to peace, human rights, gender equality, and social progress. These are women who speak and act against injustice, inequality, and insecurity. Some work to improve their communities or to better the plight of women and children. Others forge a path for others to follow. They include journalists who expose crimes against women or ties between violent extremists and local organizations, advocates for human rights and peaceful reconciliation of conflict, founders of NGOs that help women succeed, or those that band women together to seek to redress injustice. One is a nurse who contracted Ebola while treating others for the disease, recovered, and returned to work. Another is Afghanistan's first female fixed-wing Air Force pilot. Women are more than victims, said Ambassador-at-Large for Global Women's Issues, Catherine Russell.
We know that women are also important agents of change in their country, that they do positive, courageous things every day, and we want that to be part of this narrative, too. We want to show that a woman, even a woman who hasn't been involved in politics, can have a huge impact on her country, and we've seen some of those nominees here today.
You need to have courage, first of all, not fear, said awardee Arbana Jara, a Kosovar journalist.
I'm a mom of two kids. Of course, I have to work 10 to 12 hours a day and having threats and all of it. But if you are determined to go on and just go after your dream, then just not being afraid.
Any person in the world can be a person of courage, said Ambassador Russell. You just have to take a challenge and address it as best you can.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.